This is Faith Matters on 89.1, Lubbock's Voice of the Arts. Join us for a conversation about faith in everyday life, the trials, the tribulations, and the triumphs. Discussions about how faith matters to you and our community. Only on 89.1, Lubbock's Voice of the Arts. Support for Faith Matters is brought to you by Covenant Health, where faith meets the future of medicine. Now, here are your hosts, Ryan Price and David Cruz.
Welcome to Faith Matters. I'm Ryan Price along with David Cruz, and we have here in the studio again with us today Dr. Clark Cochran, who is Professor Emeritus at Texas Tech in Political Science, served there on the faculty for 37 years, and is also someone who David and I consider a real moral theologian, a deacon in the Catholic Church, and someone who can speak intelligibly about the current issue that we have with the impasse that's taking place in Congress. Today is Tuesday before this debt ceiling default is set to run out on Thursday. But regardless, even though, Clark, our listeners will know a little bit more about what happened this week by Sunday when this program airs, I think the context of where we are and where we've been remains the same. This impasse, Democrats, Republicans, this inability to come to terms. We're just wondering, Clark, could you kind of draw us a big picture from like 30,000 feet? What has brought us to this place?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. One is, if you think about it in terms of rivers and streams converging and coming together, there's two or maybe three. One are the specific difficulties related to the United States financial position, our annual debts, the national debt, the budget that has to be passed every year, and that has its own dynamics and its own stream, and that's been working on those has been very difficult for Congress and the president over the last 10 to 15 years. That's one thing. The second thing is the political stream, where partisanship has become more and more and more intense, and that collides with that fiscal stream, and that's what's produced the specific crisis this week, but also a crisis at the end of December, I think it was, of 2012, and there was one back in the summer or early spring of 2012, and beyond that, there were others. So they come together, but they're kind of in a way separate streams. And then there's kind of the underlying cultural conflicts in our society that are even theological in nature about the role of government and the role of churches and the roles of families and individuals and how we understand those. And there are profound differences about that. And that maybe you may call that a third stream. You may call it the big river that the other two streams run into. However you deal with that metaphor, those three things I think are on the table and part of what we're looking at this week.
When you say theological, what do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean is, what do our different faith commitments and how we interpret them tell us about the role of individuals, the role of families, the role of governments, the role of business, the role of churches or other nonprofit agencies? Our different faith traditions have different ways of looking at those things, and even within the faith tradition. So, you know, you can't talk about the Christian tradition because there are all kinds of differences on those issues within the Christian tradition, within the Jewish tradition as well, though less so, I think, and maybe within other religious traditions. So those color often the way we form our political allegiances, the way we think about the role of government and paying our bills, meeting our obligations, all of those kinds of things are influenced by that, those fundamental commitments we have.
Clark, while our country finds itself in this immediate crisis, right, of what is going to happen with regard to this government shutdown, debts that are facing the country, and all kinds of financial or budgetary issues, I find as I look at this, again, and Ryan, I think, used a good metaphor there from 30,000 feet, as much as I can, that this is an ongoing issue of divided government, partisanship, you used that word, that our country's been facing for years. And even if we were to resolve, and hopefully we will, these very immediate issues that are causing pain and have the potential to cause more pain in the lives of ordinary Americans, I just feel frustrated as a citizen of this country that so many things tend to be problematic, and they seem, on the surface anyway, possibly to need good human beings to fix them, to put aside differences, to come together, but yet they still continue to be at this critical boiling point, and it's very frustrating. And I think we're going to find ourselves here having a similar conversation conceivably 1 year from now, 2 years from now. What is it going to take? You've been not only a teacher of political science, but a student of government probably most of your life. What's it going to take to get us beyond this, to get people to work together?
I really don't know the answer to that. If I knew how to solve it, you know, I'd be making millions in consulting contracts somewhere. Let me back up a bit, because I think we really have to understand how we got here before we can approach anything about how we might get past that. Part of how we got here is these contentious politics of principle, everyone standing on principle. You know, I'm not going to bend unless my principle is met. And that wasn't the way American politics worked in the 40s or 50s or 30s, typically, or even the 60s and part of the 70s. The way we got here, I think, was a combination of the rise of party primaries and redistricting, so that it's very easy to stand on principle if you can't lose the next election by standing on principle. So what we have is a situation, there was a good example of this in, I think it was today's paper or yesterday's paper, about the Republican primary in Texas for lieutenant governor. There are four candidates for lieutenant governor to get the Republican nomination. Obviously, in Texas these days, if you win the Republican nomination for a statewide office, you've won the office. So how do you win the Republican nomination for lieutenant governor? You've moved as far to the right as you possibly can. Don't ever be outflanked on the right. Why? Because primary voters tend to be the most ideological, the most motivated, the most likely to turn out. Now, if I picked a state like California and talked about the Democratic primary, it would be you can't be outflanked to the left. Okay, so this is not unique to Republicans. So what that means is, if you translate that to the congressional level, and all of, and 90% or so roughly of all the districts, Democrat and Republican, are safe districts. If it's a Republican district, it's virtually impossible for a Democrat to win it. If it's a Democratic district, it's impossible for a Republican to win it. So people in those districts have to be as far to the right or left as they possibly can in order to stay in office.
Hence your division.
Hence the, not so much the division, but the intractability of it. You can only lose by moving to the center if you're in one of those districts.
Clark, we're so appreciative to have you in the studio today. When we come back, we want to continue this fascinating discussion about this current climate that we're in. And I have something particular I want to ask you about, a term, parallel universes, which so many of us seem to be living in across these United States. You're listening to Faith Matters on 89.1 Lubbock's Voice of the Arts.
You're listening to Faith Matters on 89.1 Lubbock's Voice of the Arts with your hosts Ryan Price and David Cruz, brought to you by Covenant Health, where faith meets the future of medicine.
Welcome back to Faith Matters. Ryan Price along with David Cruz, and we are sitting here today in the studio with Clark Cochran, who is Professor Emeritus at Texas Tech in Political Science and taught there for 37 years. Also a deacon in the Catholic Church and someone who takes his faith convictions very seriously with respect to how it influences his view on public policy. And Clark, before the break, you were talking about this stratification, division. I don't know. Sometimes I've heard it called balkanization of America,
yes,
where
people
are just fractured so along these blue state and red state, and even within the states, smaller, similar congressional districts. This week, a gentleman named Dan Baltz, who is senior correspondent for The Washington Post, wrote something that I want to read to you very briefly and have you respond, but revolves what he calls parallel universes. And this is what he wrote. The bonds that once helped produce political consensus have gradually eroded, replaced by competing camps that live in parallel universes, have sharply divergent worldviews, and express more distrust of opponents than they did decades ago. Many activists describe the stakes in apocalyptic terms. Mm-hmm. Now, I think the important part of that is not only the fact that we seem to have these very divergent worldviews according to where you live, what zip code you might be in, what congressional district or what state. But the thing that I find so disheartening is the way in which so many people speak about people from other places or the other side of the aisle in these kind of apocalyptic terms, almost conjuring a fear of evil, fascism, socialism, whatever it might be that would stick. And it makes it very difficult to have an honest, robust political discourse.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right, although I want to connect it with something I said before and qualify it a little bit. You used the image of red states and blue states. Most states and most areas are purple. That is a combination of red and blue. That is, the average American, if there is such a person, is purple, not red or blue. What happens, though, is that the political activists and the people who turn out in the primaries that I mentioned before the break, they are red and blue. And the people in the middle, they alienate the people in the middle, but the people in the middle don't matter for their electoral success in 90% of the congressional districts. So those people that you're just, you know, the parallel universes are the politically engaged, active, aware, ideologically committed. And they do very much live in parallel universes. And so, as you said, the worldviews are quite different. The view of what it means to be personally responsible, the role of government, the role of churches, the role of faith, all of those things they differ very significantly on. They have increasingly defined the conversation politically. Now, having said that, I also want to say that increasingly the people in the middle tend to move in that direction too, because of the way we have arranged society, or the way society has evolved. Our forms of communication, our forms of transportation, even our church communities. So church communities tend to be segregated too. We used to talk about segregation along racial lines, but the church communities tend to be segregated nowadays on economic lines, intellectual lines, ways of thinking, church shop, right? And old denominational lines that used to matter, whether somebody was a Methodist or a Presbyterian or a Catholic or a Baptist. You know, a Presbyterian could never go to a Baptist church or vice versa. Now people church shop across those lines constantly, right?
Sure.
And so what determines what they're going to buy, if you want to use the, you know, shopping images? What congregation are they going to buy? One that they feel comfortable in because of people like them. Whereas before, to a larger extent, if you were a Presbyterian, you had to get together with other Presbyterians, and they might have had different ideas and different economic status and different backgrounds. And so you were engaged in and learned to deal with people who were different from you. Now, the tendency is, it's not like it's fully realized, but the tendency is to split and to sort of sort ourselves out along these lines. Then that plays into the political dialogue and which television and radio channels we listen to and what we follow.
Just as a follow-up to that, typically we want to get news that will reinforce our belief system.
Right.
It's rare that you find somebody that is open-minded enough to say, well, I want my conventional wisdom to be challenged. But
yeah, Clark, that's a tendency in all of us, I think.
Oh,
you know, not just people on the left or right. It's true in myself. It's true of we like to hear what reinforces us. And what's changed, I think, over the last 20 years is it's much easier to find things that reinforce us and avoid sources of information that don't reinforce our
views. And this leads me to this, and it perhaps ties into Ryan's good point about parallel universes, and that is that I see, let's say in this particular instance that we're in right now, in the situation of government shutdown, a lot has been said about Obamacare. We worry about, will the government pay its debts?
Mm-hmm.
It's so much characterization of one side or the other, personal attacks.
Yes.
Or ascribing motives to one side or the other.
Yep.
Now, what I think, as I see this, is that the media, instead of being a help, which it could be, it becomes a hindrance. It becomes a hindrance because now you see people on these media outlets that are keeping score, like, okay, now who wins?
Right.
What politician wins? what politician loses, what party's up, what party's down, who saves face. I heard a politician say the other, or not a politician, a journalist say to a politician, is this going to mean losing face or saving face?
Yeah, I heard an interview the other day, somebody who was used to be a congressional staffer, and he said now with the age of Twitter, Harry Reid can't visit Mitch McConnell's office without somebody tweeting that he's visiting Mitch McConnell's office. So everything happens out in public. And we say transparency is a good thing, right? Well, not always. In the confessional, transparency would not be a particularly good thing, right? So transparency
would be interesting,
good,
but probably not good.
And so, you know, to talk honestly to one another, Harry Reid to Mitch McConnell, and to wheel and deal, you can't do that out in public. So now the saving face becomes, if the public knows that Harry Reid's visiting Mitch McConnell's office, each of them has to come out with something.
Well, here's the problem, though. We are in an age of constant electioneering.
Yeah.
And very little attention being paid to governance and what's good for the average American who really relies, for good or bad, on a government that is sound, that is fiscally responsible. Anyway, Ryan, you probably want to take us to break, right?
I don't know that I want to, but I have to. When we come back, we will continue that conversation about governance and the role of government. And especially, Clark, I'm interested to hear your perspective on the role of government from kind of a biblically based or theologically understood point of view.
Okay.
You're listening to Faith Matters with Ryan Price and David Cruz on 89.1 Lubbock's Voice of the Arts.
This is Faith Matters on 89.1 Lubbock's Voice of the Arts, hosted by Ryan Price and David Cruz, and brought to you by Covenant Health, where faith meets the future of medicine.
Welcome back to Faith Matters. I'm Ryan Price along with David Cruz, and we are sitting here in the studio today with Clark Cochran, who is professor emeritus at Texas Tech in political science and someone who is also a deacon in the Catholic Church and someone whose faith perspective in many ways shapes his understanding of public policy. Clark, before the break, we were talking about governance and the proper role of government. We began to kind of shift into that direction. And one of the things I've had this conversation in this past week with not one, not two, but three people, separate conversations about the role of government. And the 13th chapter of the book of Romans was brought up where Paul speaks about the role of government, paying taxes and things of this nature.
Right.
But in each of those conversations, this was stated in some form or fashion. Really, ideally, the church would be the one who would be helping poor people, and it would not be the role of the government. And I think behind that, there's the explicit lining out in the Constitution for the defense of the state. In the 21st century, for someone to say that, I just think to myself, you know, my church isn't going to be able to meet all the needs, even on our own doorstep. And yet, there's something idealistic about that. And, I just wonder, how should we be thinking about this, not just as public policy people, but really as people of faith?
Well, it's a very good question, and it follows up very well from what we were talking about with David just before the break. It's hard to know where to start with that. Let me start here. One way to, if you want to ask this in a very theological way, you would ask whether government is prelapsarian or postlapsarian. That is, does government exist before the fall or after the fall? Obviously using Christian imagery here. And if you think government is post-lapsarian, that is, government is an institution that exists only because of sin, its role will tend to be the restriction of sin. And the classic passage for that is Romans 13 that you alluded to, that government exists to punish evildoers, okay? And so that means government's role is going to be pretty restricted, you know, because the saints don't need it. Because the saints aren't evildoers, again, in a particular theological construct. The believers, and if believers were doing their job and all of that, then government would be really very, 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 very minimal, right? And that's an ideology, a theology, really, that drives a good bit of the political discourse today. But there's a whole line of thinking, theology, that goes way back in the Christian tradition that government is not post-lapsarian, it's pre-lapsarian. Okay? Think about it this way. Government is about authority to make decisions for the common good, for the group. So suppose humankind had never fallen. Adam and Eve have children, and they have children, and they have children, and you get a society, and it's everybody's doing well, and everybody's doing good, but you got to decide where to go on vacation. Do you go to the beach, or do you go to the mountains? Is one of them bad and one good? No, they're both good. But if all the family's going to go, you got to make a decision. You got to have some decision-making way to make a decision, even among competing goods. You need government. So in another line of the Christian tradition, again, I'm talking in the Christian tradition because it's the one I know the most about, you have the idea that government would exist and does exist to enhance the good, particularly the common good, that which affects all of us, and to make sure that justice is done in our public dealings with each other. Okay, so and that also is part of the idea, part of what's driving the political debate, is that view of government.
In that second pre-lapsarian idea of government, you're almost implying that Adam, when he's given charge to have dominion, to take care, is in some ways being given a kind of governmental responsibility.
Yeah, although when you say Adam, it tends to suggest patriarchy, which this view doesn't suggest. I mean, sometimes it does. Some people who hold this say, well, it's up to men to do all of this. But it doesn't have to be men. In other words, there has to be some form of making decisions for taking care of the animals and the world and our living together. And there are various forms of authority for doing that. In the Old Testament, it's a kind of political theology where the king is anointed by God and so forth and so on. There are ways, different ways to organize that. But you have to have some government which does more than punish wrongdoing. It also helps to build together the bonds that make us one, okay? So that those who are sick or those who are ill, those who are injured and can't work, those who have limited mental capacity, how do you knit them into the community so that they're all part of the community? And that's the role of churches, but it's also, I think, and the folks in that tradition of theology think, is also partly government's responsibility, particularly when, in the 21st century, organizations and the economy are so complex that it cannot be coordinated sort of anarchically by all the churches and other institutions kind of just doing their own thing. Mm-hmm. There needs to be some kind of central way of making sure that justice is done and the common good is served.
I think this is an excellent conversation, and I think Ryan's point is well made, and your follow-up to that point about the role of government, particularly from a biblical or spiritual perspective, I'm sitting here, I'm thinking, well, I would argue that it is precisely because of the mandates that the scriptures give us that we have to be concerned for our fellow man, and that this is accomplished not only by individuals, but to some degree by government.
Right.
If it's effective. Now, the two are not necessarily mutually exclusive or competing in entities. The role of government caring for some degree for healthcare or the poor does not, okay, excuse me as a private citizen from also caring for the poor. Jesus says it, I was hungry, you gave me to eat. I was thirsty, you gave me to drink. I was naked, you clothed me. I cannot say, in fairness, well, that's the role of government. But here's something very important. When we talk about the proper role of government, what really aches me, okay, and pains me, is that there's so much animosity in the conversation.
Yes.
Because both points could be very valid.
Yeah, I just very quickly, because I know we're running out of time, I think you're absolutely correct. The folks who emphasize the church responsibility and personal responsibility say, no, it's primarily my responsibility. Jesus didn't say government help the poor, said you. And if government does it, I'll just give up on my responsibility. Those who favor the government doing it say, well, if the government doesn't do it, the churches won't live up to their role and the poor will be lost. The best thing is a collaboration, which really characterizes the best of American society throughout its history, is the development of voluntary organizations like churches cooperating with government to meet the needs of society. and we're in danger of losing that middle.
Clark, a good place to end and a good final word. So wonderful to have you here.
It's good to be here.
I wish we could be here together longer, but we'll just have to invite you to come back once more. Yeah. Appreciate it so much. David, good to be with you as well. You've been listening to Faith Matters on 89.1 Lubbock's Voice of the Arts.